From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith, filling in for Sylvia Maria Gross. This week, free health clinics prepare for a day when everyone will have insurance.
We've always been the net under the safety net, and now we recognize that there still are going to be those people that don't have access to health care.
A freshman city councilman looks back on his first year on the job.
We in our community continue to say we want to see something different. But I think the question becomes, well, what is it that we really want? And what is it that we really want to see in our community to actually change it?
And a new report reveals the state of women's health in Missouri.
If we don't have healthy women, we don't have healthy students, we don't have healthy workers, we don't have healthy families. They all connect.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
Free health clinics have long been places to turn when you don't have health insurance or any money to pay for care. The federal health law, though, is supposed to expand health coverage to 30 million people. And while the law went before the Supreme Court last week, health providers are already gearing up for a surge in patients with insurance. As KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, that leaves free clinics into uncharted territory.
Around the country, hundreds of free clinics have been established over the last 50 years to treat patients like Patsy Duarte.
That's no good. 172 over 85.
Duarte's getting her blood pressure checked at Duchesne Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas. The Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth helped form the clinic in this old parish school about 20 years ago. There's an affiliate in Leavenworth. Duarte's been coming here for years for her hypertension, diabetes, and other health issues.
I have no insurance. I have no other means of going to a doctor. The last time that my husband went to a doctor, it was like $85 just for the visit.
Duarte says medical conditions limit her ability to work, and the couple's combined income is about $15,000 a year. The bad economy, the loss of jobs and health insurance, has also meant more people are turning to the clinic, according to director Amy Folk.
We've been kind of caught in the perfect storm of you have so many people needing care that can't get care, but at the same time, funding, you know, has been held level or in some cases decreased, so while you'd like to ramp up, this is not the economic time to do that.
And with big changes coming in the health system, folks says the clinic faces a lot of uncertainty right now. While uninsured people can and do go to community health centers and hospitals, free clinics are the only place where there's no fear of a bill. The expansion of Medicaid to an additional 16 million people means many of those who go to free clinics will get coverage. Nicole Lamoureux-Busby, head of the National Association of Free and Charitable Clinics, says free clinics expect to still be an important part of the healthcare safety net. Millions of people still won't have coverage.
The Congressional Budget Office itself says that there are going to be anywhere from 23 to 29 million uninsured people left in this country. So first and foremost, we will continue to service as the gap fillers in this country. We've always been the net under the safety net, and now we recognize that there still are going to be those people that don't have access to healthcare.
In the Kansas City area, that could translate to an estimated 85,000 uninsured people. Lamoureux-Busby says many clinics will also have a role in helping people figure out the new system.
It sounds great to have everyone be eligible between 2014 and 2019, but there's not this magic potion or a magic wand that's going to get people signed up. Somebody's going to have to help them. We're going to have to explain now a very complicated system that quite frankly ignored many of our patients in the past.
Duchesne Free Clinic Director Amy Falk says the clinic's already been responding to a changing health system by trying to be more of a primary care center for patients. The clinic's thought a lot about the situation and the access challenges patients already face.
I don't think we can stay as we are. I think we have to grow within our environment.
Folk says the harsh reality is the region's safety net system is already stretched thin and wrestling with how to respond to current needs. If anything, Folk predicts more people will be turning to Duchesne Clinic for care in the future. So she says the clinic has decided to take Medicaid and private insurance if health coverage expands.
It will totally change the culture and structure of this clinic. Having never had to do these things and building the infrastructure, one, to put in place, but just how we do our daily workflow, it will change.
For those who decide to go in this direction, taking Medicaid and private insurance could alter the nature of free clinics who rely on volunteers like Dr. Glenn Hodges of the Health Partnership Clinic in Overland Park.
I'm a medical missionary 3 miles from where I live, taking care of people in my neighborhood.
Dr. Hodges has been a happy volunteer at the Health Partnership Clinic since he retired from the VA more than 10 years ago. This clinic is making some sweeping changes, regardless of what happens with the federal health law, that will include taking Medicaid and private coverage and qualifying for more federal funds. The white-bearded Hodges, who's also a master rose gardener, says he plans to stay with the clinic. He and most other volunteers will focus on patients who don't have coverage. Staff will focus on those with coverage.
Patients who are receiving free care are going to continue to be there. It's two separate patient populations, will require two separate administrative organizational structures. There's a need for both.
That attitude is great news for new Health Partnership Clinic Director Jason Wesko, who used to run a community health center in Kansas that took insurance.
We're in the midst of rethinking what insured means and uninsured. Because historically, the uninsured have been the people without the plastic card, right? It has had nothing to do with their health needs or their health status or anything else. It's had to do with whether they have a card. So like today, I have a card. If I quit my job and go to work for somebody else tomorrow, I may or may not have a card. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's completely employer-based or whether you have a public benefit. And so if healthcare reform continues as is currently law, we're going to have a big expansion of Medicaid in Kansas, which is good because it's very hard for a working adult. I mean, working adults can't be on Medicaid in Kansas. You have to be disabled or have kids, essentially. So that's going to expand, and then the exchanges are going to expand, and people with incomes up to 400% of poverty can be fully subsidized on the exchange, right? Well, that changes a lot about our patients, or does it? It might mean they have a piece of plastic in their pocket. They have the same health care needs. They're the same people who have not been getting health care for all their lives or getting it at the ER in very expensive ways.
Wesko knows the transition to accepting insurance takes planning, like training staff and putting in an electronic medical record system. He knows he'll still need volunteers like Dr. Hodges, though, as well as more paid staff to handle extra patients and manage the changes.
I exist to help my patients get healthier and to take care as many of as I can in the highest quality manner possible. So how do I create a system where I can bill for services? Well, you know, I do. I just do it. Just like I created a system to manage 100 volunteers. That, to me, is a lot harder than billing Medicaid.
For clinics who go in this direction, there can be bigger changes, too, involving malpractice coverage and, in some states, changing Medicaid laws.
The bottom line is we have growing need, and our job is to worry about all those people we don't take care of, and how do I get the resources to make sure that no one in Johnson County goes without health care. That's a big job, and the only way I can adequately do that is bring more resources to this organization.
Free clinic directors say the next few years will be hard work, but they say with decades of stretching resources, responding to changing community needs, and caring for people with complex health problems, they'll rise to the challenge. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
This story is part of a partnership with KCUR, NPR, and Kaiser Health News.
Kansas City's 3rd District faces multiple challenges: a 14% unemployment rate, crime, and the highest poverty rate in the city. Last year, Jermaine Reed was elected to represent the 3rd District, the youngest councilman ever to have served on city council. Enthusiastic supporters said Reed represented fresh ideas and a youth perspective. But before long, he was criticized for being politically naive and inexperienced, launching a recall effort that was eventually abandoned. I sat down with Reed to talk about his first 9 months in office, including accomplishments, future plans, and lessons learned.
I was born and raised in the 3rd District. My family, for the most part, lived in the 3rd District all my life. I went to schools in the Kansas, Missouri School District and was part of the community now that I represent for my entire life.
Well, when we think about the third district, we think about the multiple and probably complex challenges. I mean, you've got crime, you've got lack of economic development, and many, many other issues. As a councilman, how do you even get your focus, or how do you prioritize the issues that you're going to work on in the third district?
Coming to City Hall and making sure that I'm focused on the needs and concerns of our residents. If we had time, I certainly would talk about that I've been focused on this entire year. And the first one, I certainly would talk about the Aldi's grocery store, which is going to be built at 39th and Prospect. And so when I start talking about eliminating a food desert and hopefully bring in other grocery stores in the area, it's from being able to work with the Full Employment Council to provide jobs for young people between the ages of 18 and 14 years old who are unemployed in the in targeted areas of Jackson County. In addition to some housing that we have going, in addition to East Patrol Campus, which is going to be built at 27th and Prospect, and a host of other things that I certainly could talk about how I come and try to make the best of what I can do every day to make sure that citizens in Kansas City, and especially our third district, are seeing real change every day.
You mentioned many projects, and some of which are pretty complex and will take some time to really come to fruition. What do you see as the low-hanging fruit in the third district, easy things that you can tackle and get some immediate results?
I would say that things like curbs and sidewalks and being able to improve our parks and our park systems, those are certainly low-hanging fruit. Just last month, the city council approved $3.2 million in PIAC funds, which goes toward public infrastructure. They're low-hanging fruits, but they're also big-hanging fruits for people who have to live that life every day where you go outside and you don't necessarily have a sidewalk, or you try to take your kid down to the park and you don't even have a quality swing set, and if it gets dark, there's not even a light that comes on. And so these are low-hanging, but they're big-hanging fruits for people who have to deal with it every day, and they're things that we are certainly get done, and it's part of the reason why we've approved $3.2 million to get them done.
Now, you serve as vice chair of the Public Safety and Emergency Services Committee. What key initiatives are you concerned with as it relates to the third district that come through this committee?
One of the biggest things that we certainly heard throughout this budget cycle was about firefighters and not wanting to have 105 firefighters lose their jobs, and just knowing, of course, that out of our $1.6 billion budget that we have to oversee here in Kansas City, 50% of that really is public safety. So from our firefighters to our police to our hospitals, those are basic things that we have to have. Another one of the things that I pushed for a great deal back in September of 2011 when we first came on the council was that I urged the mayor and the city council to implement the 2006 Violent Crimes Commission report and pulled it off the shelf. And it had a number of recommendations in that time that talked about how we reduce crime and violence in the urban core, and the mayor has since appointed the implementation board, and they've been meeting regularly, and they are going to be putting some of those recommendations that were in that report into action.
I was going to ask you about that because, of course, we know Kansas City has been plagued by violent crime, and that has ebbed and flowed throughout the years, and there have been task forces. You have Aim for Peace that is a program to try to reduce violent crime, but it seems like we're not making the headway. What's the promise of this new implementation board? What do you think they'll accomplish that hasn't been accomplished before?
Well, Aim for Peace, actually, as you mentioned, was even one of the things that came out of the 2006 Violent Crimes report. But there also are a number of things in terms of how do we engage our young people to, you know, statistics of which type of organizations or services are available for persons throughout our community. I am confident that that report and their recommendations as an implementation board will come back to us that will provide us ways to, if it's some legislation that we can help pass throughout the city so that we can reduce crime and violence in our communities, or if it's just programs that are also recommended in that report that we're able to implement as well. So there will be some concrete things that will happen, and I'm confident that it will.
Now, you mentioned the new police station, and I know that there was criticism from residents about being displaced from their homes. There was criticism about them not being compensated enough. But then the troublesome point, I think, for you was then it culminated or it contributed to this recall effort that went on. And I know some people were concerned that you said, get over it, or that was alleged that you said. Let's talk about that. Can you shed more light and maybe clear up some of the controversy that surrounded this whole issue?
The reality of it is that I've never, ever in my life sold anyone to get over anything. And if anything, that was a really hard decision that not only I had to make, but the other third district at large person, who is Councilwoman Curls, myself, the mayor, the police board commission, we all had a say into which area was selected for the new police station. Now, also on top of that, we went through, I believe it was 25 locations that we had to look at in terms of which site we would pick as the best site for the new police station and crime lab. Out of those 25 sites, the 27th and Prospect location was the one that rang to the top. My family literally lived right on 27th and Prospect. It was a little bit down the street. And I remember, and I even drive by there today and see ladies of the night and see people who hang out on the corner. And I even remember back in 96 when HBO did a special on 27th and Prospect. And we in our community continue to say, we want to see something different. But I think the question becomes, well, what is it that we really want? And what is it that we really want to see in our community to actually change it? And I am quite confident that in the next 2 to 3 years, we will transform 27th and Prospect one block at a time with this new police station. And to even answer the question when you start talking about when people allege that I said get over it to some residents, it's just certainly not true. Every time I've had a conversation with any resident in the area, the 60 households that are being displaced and they will be getting the relocation benefits, every time I've talked to them, I continue to say, you are making the ultimate sacrifice for your community because you're giving up a home that you perhaps have lived in for 40 years or 30 years or you've inherited. You are making an ultimate sacrifice so that we could see something different in our community. And I'll be forever grateful to those people because the amount of money we pay them, even if it's $3 million that I was able to get, we'll never be able to repay them for the memories that that home that they're losing has shared. We'll never be able to repay them for the sacrifices and the blood, sweat, and tears that they put into the home that they lived in for so many years.
Now, here you are, eager to serve your community, youngest city council member ever, and people are trying to recall you. How did you even kind of respond to that at the time? That must have been very demoralizing.
Well, Oprah, it was a tough at the time when people cause a distraction is really what I called it. For me, it was something that I was just reminded from words of my grandmother, who always says, you know, stay focused on the big things that are important to you. And I'm thankful that I've had an opportunity to even meet with the pastor who alleged a lot of the things. And he and I've had a conversation and we talked about how we both can make change in our community. And I don't necessarily think we'll hear from him again about recalling, because if anything, we want the best for our community.
By the way, that was Pastor Henderson Belt that you were referring to that had something to do with the recall. Well, you know, all public officials are criticized both publicly and privately, and that kind of goes with the territory. So how do you respond to critics who say, oh, Jermaine Reed, he doesn't listen to advice, he thinks he has it all down, or if we give him feedback, he doesn't incorporate it? How do you respond to people who say things like that or think things like that?
The reality of it is that I take a lot of advice. I hear advice from all sorts of people. At the end of the day, I think that I have a job to do on behalf of 78,000 citizens in the 3rd District, but 500,000 people here in Kansas City, Missouri. And I believe that I was elected to make the best decision. And so at the end of the night, I've got to be able to sleep very well so that I could get back up early in the morning and be able to make a difference all over again. And so sometimes people could say, well, he's not listening. Well, it's probably because I didn't necessarily take the advice that they wanted me to take, but I took somebody else's advice. So it's a hard position that any public servant can find themselves in.
Not to talk about another controversy. Let's talk renaming Prospect Avenue Martin Luther King, which you took a hit for. You were an advocate of the change, but with all the public outcry that went on the back burner, What was it that people didn't understand about your original intent in advocating for that?
The reality of it is that it was never, ever about the street. But my whole approach is that given the history of Dr. King and given what he actually stood for and given what we can work toward as a community, is that our street may look like one thing now, but if we work toward the bigger picture, we will see a totally different Martin Luther King Street later on. And that's part of the reason when I start talking about the Prospect Plan, when I start talking about the new grocery store that's coming on 39th and Prospect, when I start talking about 27th and Prospect, when I could talk about new housing from 18th to 26th and Prospect. And these are things that are extremely important to revitalizing what Prospect actually looks like. And I can even go down outside of my district to 63rd and Prospect with the Citadel project, which is now going to be all restored. And we as a community can work towards something and a big goal to make something look different. And it will be a street that we will be happy to call Dr. Martin Luther King, because we'll be able to say, hey, we work toward it. And frankly, I'm not committed to just saying Prospect is the street that we have to rename. It was a street that was part of a conversation that I've had, and part of a conversation that I've had with community people as well.
So partly the name provides kind of the vision, the impetus to transform it into something different.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are some lessons learned? Because everybody in public office every year brings new lessons, I think.
Yeah, and the reality of it is that I'm still learning every day. And so, yes, I've learned from some mistakes over the past year. I could say my Prospect was one lesson learned in terms of making sure I have more community input and dialogue, and in terms of something that has such an effect in the entire and broader community. I mean, that's certainly a lesson learned, to be able to talk with residents and get their feedback, which is what I've been doing. I look forward to the next 3 years and even four more years thereafter when I'm reelected as a second termer.
That was City Councilman Jermaine Reed, serving in a 3rd District in-district position.
Coming up, how healthy are women in Missouri? You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia is away this week. Back in 2004, the health and economic status of Missouri women was rated a C- by Women's Policy Research. Have we made progress since then? A recently released Missouri Women's Health Report says there's good news and bad news. Women have made gains in the workforce and in higher education, but Missouri women are more likely to live in poverty and still face barriers in employment, education, and health care access. The 74-page Missouri Women's Report was a joint project by the Women's Policy Alliance and MU's Office of Social and Economic Data Analysis. Susan talked with one of the key researchers, Kristen Metcalf-Wilson, about the report's findings. She explained these are not just issues of sickness and wellness.
One of the issues that our report looks at is not only the well-being of women in the, you know, their status, their health status, particularly with diabetes and cardiovascular disease and breast cancer and unintended pregnancies. We look at a lot of specific health issues, but we also look at how women access the system. So do they have public or private insurance? By having that insurance, do they actually improve their outcomes? Because I think regardless of whether someone has insurance, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have a healthier pregnancy if they don't understand or have access to the providers to help them. So interesting to note in the report is that we have some of the poorest women in our state, which live in the southeast region of the state, are some of the poorest women in the state, but because of that level of poverty that they're in, they actually are more likely to have insurance because they receive state insurance or Medicaid. But we still do not see improved infant mortality rates, improved controlled diabetes, improved breast cancer survival rates. So just because they're insured doesn't necessarily mean that they have an appreciation for getting screenings, preventive care, getting in early for pregnancy and prenatal care, those types of issues. So it's more than a single thing. Hopefully legislators can understand that poverty is has an impact on health, just as receiving insurance or providing insurance for someone does.
Now, getting deeper into some of these health indicators, I was surprised to learn that Missouri ranked 10th for the fewest deaths in breast cancer.
Yes, and that's something we should be proud of.
Yes, what do you attribute this result?
Well, one of the programs that the state of Missouri has is a Show Me Healthy Women's program, which is a fabulous program, and it allows women that are uninsured or unable to afford mammograms receive those mammograms in a timely fashion, and then providers around the state sign up for that program to be able to offer the service. The unfortunate thing is that we could do even better if we fully funded that program, because it historically runs out of money before the year is up, and also doesn't necessarily provide treatment once something is found. So it is a screening program. But it does allow women to get that screening early and on time and not delay it because they're afraid of cost.
Now, you also measure unintended pregnancies, which you point out it makes an impact on achieving educational goals and workforce participation.
Mm-hmm.
But one challenge certainly is, and part of your recommendation is more family planning services. Yet, is this realistic with some of the recent challenges to family planning services?
Yeah, the state of Missouri is quite divided on contraceptive or reproductive health, and so it is an issue. But if you remove the controversy and just look at the facts, unintended pregnancy is a huge public health burden to particular communities and to the state. And it's quite proven that women that have unintended pregnancies have an increased risk for poor outcomes and actually delay education or workforce opportunities in order to deliver that pregnancy or choose abortion as an option. So if you want to bring down the numbers of abortion, certainly improving those unintended pregnancy rates would make a big difference. And the unintended pregnancy, just to define it, some people just think, well, they kind of have a vision in their head that, well, this is the teenager or the adolescent that you know, wasn't using protection, but unintended pregnancy is really defined by the mother at birth. So when we record those statistics, you know, unintended doesn't necessarily mean unwanted. So these could be working women with families of their own that, for whatever reason, got pregnant at a time that they weren't planning on it.
And as you point out, another piece of good news in this report was that actually teen pregnancy is down.
It is. Teen pregnancy is down for the state of Missouri, and actually is pretty competitive with national levels. So that's something else we should look at to say, well, what is this? How are we improving it? And hopefully one of the things that help us reduce that number even more is access to reproductive health care for long term. So at any age, women can control the size of their family.
What do we think we did right to reduce teen pregnancy, which I know is a hot issue for some years?
It is. You know, we look at different counties, and while some counties in the state as a whole are down, we should remember also that there are some counties that are still very high. So while we might have unintended pregnancy rate as a state that's pretty competitive, we have areas of the state that still have those high pregnancy rates.
And what are some of those areas?
If you look at the birth rates that are down for the state, we are at our lowest rate since the year 2000. But if we look at our numbers in the southeast region again, it's a concentrated area down there that have the highest numbers of birth to teens, 15 to 19, in that Boot Heel area mm-hmm. of the state. And some would argue, and I guess I would too after doing this research, is it about access to providers or education about how to protect yourself or prevent a pregnancy that might be our problem in specific areas of the state?
One of your other recommendations regarding health care access is improved access to Medicaid and private providers' prenatal care. Now, as far as I know, this has been an issue for over 30 years, but it doesn't seem to change, I think largely because of the budget implications. You just have to be able to pay providers, private providers especially, more money to do prenatal care for Medicaid populations.
Yes.
So how do we address that when we have been so unsuccessful in getting any change in this area, really over the past 20, 30 years?
Right. It is a... it is and has been an issue historically for access to prenatal care. And I think one of the things that would be beneficial would be to look at Medicaid reimbursement for prenatal care, because while we may have providers in, say, the southeast area of the state that provide prenatal care in their local communities, if they're private providers, receiving private insurance reimbursement is higher than public insurance reimbursement. And so they're more likely to fill their practices with private pay patients, privately insured patients, versus publicly insured patients. And so then that then comes around for this woman to receive care, prenatal care, to have to drive great lengths, big distances, to get care from a hospital that won't turn people away, a non-for-profit or an academic health center that would see any number of people. But private practices will actually limit the type of patients they'll take based on the reimbursement.
Now, on another note, you say more women are working, and especially urban women. But I'm wondering if the supports that women who work need, like child care and elder care, have kept pace with this trend, because certainly that would have policy implications.
Yeah, and, you know, child care is skyrocketing. Being mother myself, I was happy at the days when we no longer needed that service in my family. But it is very difficult for women to find affordable, safe, quality child care in their own communities. And if they don't have family close by that will be able to do that at even odd hours, say shift work or evenings or nights, it makes it very challenging for women to leave the house with young children. So when we see women, you know, numbers improving in the workforce, I think we need to look at those counties that are doing it well and perhaps model some of those things in other counties. And we see in metropolitan areas, transportation may be easier if there's public transportation available to get to and from work. But if you're in a very rural area and, say, your partner or husband has a job and there's only one car,
right,
how then do you both get to work?
Yeah, that's certainly a dilemma.
Yeah, and if you're trying to get children to and from daycare or even school, you know, without transportation available, it makes it very difficult. I mean, one thing I think we should look forward to is, you know, internet access. If we can improve internet access in rural areas, more women can attend even GED classes online now. So there's opportunity ahead, I think, but we need to be committed to making those things happen.
Women are living longer, and of course they outlive men. That's something we knew. But the downside of that is that their physical and economic health may not always be good.
Very true. In fact, we know in the state of Missouri, the biggest disparity we see among men and women in poverty are women over the age of 65. That number is 38% on the average for women 65 and older for the state. But in some counties, it's as high as 49 and 59%.
Now, what are the factors that impact that primarily?
Well, you know, if we look at those baby boomers, which that number will increase, I mean, women living longer than men, but now we have a large population set at 65 and getting older. So we look that those numbers could possibly increase. And that's important to recognize because women in that generation may or may not have been in the workforce as long, and or created their own pension or retirement fund. And so if their husband or spouse dies or the pension that they lived off of with their spouse is gone, they are basically on a very limited income.
So I also notice that you say the age of the first marriage is increasing. So the age that people are getting married for the first time is increasing. And there are increasing numbers of women who are never married. What are some of the implications of these statistics?
Well, it does tell us that women are making choices, you know, either to start a family or get married, because they may delay those big decisions in life because they have more opportunity. And in the state of Missouri, it does really well at getting women into college. We actually have more women attending college than men in the state of Missouri, and sometimes 4-1 in some counties. So we do see women seeking higher education opportunities, and many research would say that is a key indicator when you see that delay in marriage or delay in first pregnancy.
So another good news, bad news scenario in your report, women have achieved parity to men in higher education, which is good news. But the thing that stuck out to me is that there's still a great disparity among pay, women making about 74% of what men make.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So what are the factors here?
Well, we're consistent with the national average for our state, about 74 cents to the dollar. In some areas of the state, we do better. In some areas, we do worse. We tend to see that wage gap close with women attending college. They may get to 85 cents to a dollar, or maybe even 90 cents to a dollar, but they still cannot completely close that wage gap disparity between men and women working with the same education and the same job.
So you also point out that just like Congress and Senate nationally, women don't fare as well compared to men in getting congressional and Senate seats. A little better in our Missouri legislature than the Senate.
Yes.
And also there's a need for more county commissioners. How do we make this happen, though?
Yes, in the report we do note that we find women more likely to run for non-paying positions, so your school board or your city council, those kinds of non-paid elected positions, but you're less likely to see women run for paid positions. I think it's a very good question to get out there. There's organizations around the state that help support women running for office. We certainly, as an organization, the Women's Policy Alliance, would like to see that happen, because we do know that the evidence supports that policy changes that impact women are more likely to impact them in a positive way if there are more women at the table making those decisions.
Well, as we close, and I know it's very hard to summarize in a nutshell what you think broad recommendations would be. I mean, you have a list of them. But what do you really want policymakers to take away from this report?
Well, I would really hope that they utilize the report as a tool when making policy decisions, because as we can see, there are some things in the report that we note are positive things for women and that we do well, and that we can use this information to help continue to support those programs and the efforts of policymakers to continue to support those programs, but also start to make changes in some of the policy we have that we know create more barriers for women to get out of poverty. One of the things that I continue to speak about with the Women's Policy Alliance, and when we talk about this report, is that we can't isolate these issues. There's a reason that there are four different sections of this report, because they all impact each other. If we don't have healthy women, we don't have healthy students, we don't have healthy workers, we don't have healthy families. They all connect. And so hopefully this will create a bigger picture to have these discussions about, so that when we talk about improving healthcare access, that we know that it's not just about insurance or access to the system, but how do we then get women engaged in the system and educating themselves to be healthy? So there's so many things that intertwine with one another. You can't just separate an issue and think fixing one problem is going to change it all.
Well, we thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
You're most welcome.
That was Kristen Metcalf-Wilson, an assistant teaching professor in the MU Sinclair School of Nursing, who helped compile the Missouri Women's Report.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
After the break, Kansas City is struck by the zombie craze. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, the KU Jayhawks spent the weekend in New Orleans for the Final Four, but it was MU's coach who got the Coach of the Year awards. And the Kansas City, Missouri Council approved a budget with cuts in almost every department. KCUR's Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
There'll be less money for street repairs, no leaf and brush pickup, fewer mowings of the parks, and water and sewer rate increases. But the city budget cut that got the most attention was the $7.6 million pared from fire department spending. Mayor Sly James maintained that the city had done the right thing.
Don't have to agree with us, don't have to love us for it, but we've done what we thought was right.
James also said if the firefighters' union accepts contract changes the city is proposing, it could avoid laying off up to 105 firefighters. A council committee voted not to put an initiative from the anti-nukes group Peace Planters on the public ballot, though Chair Ed Ford said if there are enough signatures, the charter says to do that.
Even if it would scare away businesses and developers, we have an obligation to put it on the ballot.
The city attorney says two of three parts of the initiative are unconstitutional. As 14 candidates campaigned for seats on the Kansas City School Board, Clay County Representative Myra Neth introduced a bill in Jefferson City to replace the elected board with a group appointed by the mayor and the Missouri Education Commissioner.
We've just got to put a stop to the existing governance.
Superintendent Steve Green called it a hasty move.
It seems to be quite rushed.
The bill would also convert the city's most troubled schools into charter schools. A number of bills involving the right not to have to provide insurance that covers birth control or participate as professionals in abortions, sterilizations, and providing or selling things some people have religious objections to advanced in both the Missouri and Kansas legislatures. Conservative Kansas Representative Lance Kinzer said religious expression is basic to this country.
It's why the pilgrims came to America in the first place.
Kinzer was supporting a broadly based bill that says governments shouldn't pass laws that infringe on people's religious beliefs. The fate of all those bills remained to be seen, but the fate of one ending the power of Kansas courts over school funding and other appropriations matters was sealed. It failed a second vote. And in Missouri, it was certain that a ballot measure on a constitutional amendment allowing voter photo ID will not call it the Voter Protection Amendment.
I had assumed that the court would just rewrite the title and move on.
Said sponsor Bill Stouffer after a court sent the amendment back to the legislature to have the ballot language rewritten. But Stouffer denies it was written as it was to deceive voters. K-State basketball coach Frank Martin accepted a job at South Carolina. Athletic director John Curry denied rumors it was because the two didn't get along and shed some light on a receipt that led to the suspension of key player Jamar Samuels from the game that ended the Wildcats' postseason play.
It was found on the floor or on the trash at the grocery store, and it was brought to the compliance office.
KU's hoopsters were off to New Orleans for a matchup with Ohio State. Player Thomas Robinson said team members never stopped believing that they'd have a spot in the Final Four.
Feels great, man, because, you know, coming into this year, nobody expected us to be here at all. So, I mean, it shows you that this program is stronger than what anybody thinks, you know.
As the KU team warmed up for the big dance in New Orleans, MU coach Frank Haith won the Associated Press Coach of the Year poll. This is KCUR.
Zombies have been everywhere. They're the subject of the hit AMC show called Walking Dead, which drew in more viewers than the network's Emmy favorite, Mad Men. You may have seen them out on the streets during zombie walks, where people dress and walk like zombies, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention even released a zombie graphic novel, a clever disguise for an emergency preparedness guide. What you may not know, though, is that Kansas City has its very own zombie claim to fame. It's a full-scale production series online called Dead Weight. Casey Curran's Kayla Regan sat down with the director, Justin Parlett, to find out how the undead on the web are taking the town.
You weren't supposed to be... zombies...
Well, the show Deadweight centers around a character named Adam Aldred, played by Dan Hilliker. And basically, it asks the questions, what if you prepared for the wrong apocalypse?
This is Justin Parlett, the director of Deadweight. You just heard a clip from the show. And believe it or not, he's not as into the undead as one might think.
I'd watched the classic Romero films. I'd seen Zombie 2, where the zombie fights the shark. But I wouldn't consider myself someone who sits up at night making my zombie escape plan.
What he is staying up and doing, though, is working on Deadweight.
I was up until 2 a.m. last night approving audio mixes. I put in a lot of hours.
The web series, now in its second season, centers around a paranoid shut-in named Adam as he tries to survive zombie-infested Kansas City. It's getting some good attention. They're screening an episode at the Kansas City Independent Film Commission. And last year, after a complimentary review from an IMBD connection, they were invited to San Diego Comic-Con.
Which is a pretty big, hairy deal.
Comic-Con is the holiest of holy grounds for fans of fantasy, graphic novels, and all things traditionally nerdy. It's where they screen Twilight and other big-budget movies. You can walk up to graphic novel superstars like Marvel Comics chairman Stan Lee and actually talk to them.
And then there's my little web series, too. And that was really kind of amazing. But that was a moment when I said, okay, this is kind of a game changer. I maybe should take this a little bit more seriously.
In its first season, Deadweight's $300 budget was basically self-funded and everything was volunteer.
We were just making something for the sake of making something. We were tired of sitting in coffee shops and saying, wouldn't it be cool if we made this, or writing scripts and then putting them in a file somewhere.
But this season, they have a full-scale production crew with cinematographers, multiple cameramen, a production coordinator, and a lot more. They even get paid.
At one point, we had probably 40 people running around set between cast and crew, getting everything ready on season two. But yeah, it was a much larger endeavor this time around.
The team working on special effects has also worked on projects like Peter Jackson's King Kong. Perlett's also really proud of the score, written by Tim Farrell of the group Ludo on Island Records.
And I really think that without the music, the show is not anywhere near the level that it is with that score.
All of this is in large part thanks to Deadweight's fans. They raised over $2,000 from Kickstarter, a website that lets you fund projects directly from the people who support you.
We just say, okay, maybe instead of going to Starbucks today, you give us that $3, and then we can make more of the show you like.
And they're going to be making a lot more episodes. Perlett has got about 7 seasons planned out. He knows where the show's going.
Everyone dies. No, no, no.
Now, watch out. This is a spoiler alert. Perlett did give away one scene where he makes a cameo.
Not to give too much away, but I get eaten. And that was a heck of a lot of fun.
He says that was one of his favorite scenes to film, especially because a lot of the zombies were fans who donated to the show through Kickstarter. He does have his down moments, though.
But probably the least favorite part is after an episode is launched, just sitting there waiting for somebody to say something. You know, that's very nerve-wracking, because once you put it out there, okay, I have no control over this anymore. And you're just waiting for either somebody on Facebook to click like or a YouTube comment to come in. And, you know, depending on how long it takes for that to happen, sometimes you're just biting your nails and hating life and wishing you hadn't done this at all. And then people come in and say really nice things and you're excited again.
Even though his fans come from around the world, the show is very, very local. It's almost like a zombie love letter to Kansas City.
I love Kansas City. You never see Kansas City portrayed as Kansas City in the movies. It's very rare for that to happen. I'm not a native of this city, but it's my home, and I want to make things here with people here.
It certainly is his home, and he pays homage to it in little ways throughout the series, like right here.
Avoid Troost, avoid Emmanuel Cleaver Boulevard. While we don't know what's causing this, we can try to keep the violence contained. They're here.
Perlett says Deadweight was the only web series at Comic-Con that wasn't based in New York or Los Angeles. He said everyone was pretty surprised about that, and in a good way.
But just that, oh, I didn't know you could do stuff like that there. And of course we can. We have a very active and vivid film scene here. We really wanted to do something that was in Kansas City. We wanted to work with Kansas City and Missouri-based talent and make something that we could show to people nationally.
What Perlett didn't expect was how much Deadweight would impact his life, both professionally and personally.
I was expecting it like, okay, these are my hired guns. You know, this is my gunslinger. I'm bringing him in. I wasn't expecting it to turn into, you know, a group of people that we would all still go out and get cocktails together. And that's what it is. And that's really amazing.
Of course, the question still remains. Out of all the fictional characters in the world, why zombies? Especially for a guy who's really not that into them.
Zombies are so incredibly popular because they speak to us. We're going through situations right now where we have people who can't find jobs. They're wandering around aimlessly, not knowing what they're going to be doing. You know, there's this very capitalistic idea that we can infinitely grow our economy and our species on a finite planet. And that just doesn't work. Eventually, we start to eat ourselves. And that's kind of where I think our fascination with zombies right now comes into play.
The show doesn't seem inspired by that idea, though. It doesn't go for straight scares either.
The tone for the show is basically a less campy version of maybe the film Zombieland. And what we want to do is be able to make you laugh, but not be as slapstick about it.
So what does Parlette do when the inevitable zombie apocalypse happens for real in Kansas City?
Oh, I die. I die very quickly. In the actual zombie apocalypse, I'm a goner. Forget it.
You can find Deadweight on YouTube, Twitter, or at deadweight.com.
And there's a hyphen between dead and weight, and it's W-A-I-T, because it's dead weight for you.
For Casey Currents, I'm Kayla Regan.
Well, we thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived, along with all of our past shows, on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross. Alex is the assistant producer. Kayla Regan and Carrie Coogan are our interns. And our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.